Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Trevor Burrus.
And I'm Aaron Powell.
Joining us today is Baylin Linekin, a food lawyer, scholar, adjunct law professor, and Farm-to-Consumer Legal Defense Fund board member. He's the author of 2016's Biting the Hands That Feed Us, How Fewer Smarter Laws Would Make Our Food System More Sustainable. Welcome to Free Thoughts, Baylin.
Thanks very much for having me on. Appreciate it.
You start your book with a story of Chef Mark Donitis's artisanal salumeria, which I think was a new word to me, and you kind of reference that in the book, in my hometown of Denver, Colorado, and how certain laws made it difficult for him to have his business. So I think it's a good story because it kind of says the two sides of these laws can hurt people, especially food safety laws. So what is the story of Chef Mark Donitis's artisanal salumeria?
It is, a sad story, but one that was initially one of, of sort of joy and artisanship. Mark is from Western Massachusetts. I'm from the North Shore of Massachusetts, so I feel some kindred spirit with him. He lives in Denver or just outside, and he started this artisanal salumeria, which is a nice or fancier way of saying that he made things like sausages and dry cured meats in the Denver area. He started it 5 or 6 years ago now, and instantly it was a hit. I mean, he was buying his hogs from a local agriculture, sustainable ag farm, and he was only using just a few ingredients. I think I wrote a Reason column about him a few years back, and he said that he just used animals, pork, salt, spices, and thyme, T-I-M-E, as opposed to T-H-Y-M-E. And that was really all he did. And as many people know, the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA, has some strict regulations around production and slaughter and whatnot. And an inspector must be on site at all times when you're slaughtering and or processing meats. And he did so. He worked with the USDA. He was incredibly successful. He won awards within months of starting up. He was being lauded by magazines in Denver. He won Eater.com, gave him an award as an outstanding new chef. And he was, the talk of the town. I guess, Trevor, you said you grew up around Denver, and I don't know if you thought of the place as this sort of bastion of old world meats, but
that's the first thing I think of, really.
Yeah. But he was hailed as turning Denver into that kind of place. Bravo, the network that airs Top Chef, hailed him as, quote, the sausage king. So he was incredibly successful right off the bat when he, both with customers and also with the USDA, who inspected all of his foods and found nothing wrong with them at all. And that was great up until one day when the USDA decided that his methods, his old world methods, that had achieved safe results were no longer sufficient. Again, not because of any pathogens found in the food or anything like that. The USDA just decided it was going to enforce some existing regulations differently. And it ordered him to either add nitrates or nitrites, which help dehydrate the meat. And really, I think water is the thing in foods like that that can help breed pathogens. And he said, listen, I've been achieving great results. You know this. I have independent testing. I've sold these meats to the U.S. military. There's overwhelming evidence that my food is safe and my methods are safe. And the USDA said, well, that's too bad. Your choice is either to add nitrates or nitrites or to close up shop. And Donitis, shop was called Il Mondo Vecchio, which translates to the old world. And from most of the history of the old world, nitrates and nitrites weren't added to meats during the curing process. And he said, you know, listen, I built my whole business on this model of using old world methods and, you know, modern science to ensure that food is that I'm producing is tasty and safe. And he said, and I can't do that to my customers. So he chose, instead of changing his method, simply to close up shop.
But I mean, if we're talking about old world cured meat production, I imagine that a bunch of people got sick back in, say, whether it's 17th century, 18th century. Seems like nitrates or nitrites, I mean, they do something effectively, I think, at least to prevent those kind of pathogens, correct?
They do. They do. And although, I mean, one could just as easily argue that, you know, of all the meats that are recalled around the country for having pathogens, most, if not all of them, were produced using nitrates or nitrites. So they're no guarantee. But my argument in the book and elsewhere is that if one can achieve excellent results, you know, that they verify through testing and whatnot, you know, you can, there, you know, there are different ways to, you know, skin a cat, or to make sausage, safely and tastily. And Donitas did everything right. He did everything he was supposed to up until what he was supposed to do changed. So, you know, it's a question of whether, we should allow people the freedom to produce foods, you know, that are inarguably safe, using methods that they find appropriate or that, you know, they've been using for some period of time, or whether we should have the government tell us how we're attempting to make food and giving us, you know, sort of a, you know, a one choice. Obviously I'm not in favor of the government telling us, you know, there's only one way to do something that, you know, not only stifles traditional methods, but it also stifles innovation.
But why do we have, what's special about food in this arena? Because you could analogize the story that you've just told to someone who, a medical provider who sees, say, children and practices traditional old world methods, and the children have been safe for a long time, but this guy says, you know, like you can prevent the flu with lemon juice or something, and no children's gotten sick to date. But we say, look, you know, that's not acceptable. Like, you can't practice medicine that way, because just because someone hasn't gotten sick doesn't mean that they're not going to get sick. That, you know, we're trying to practice preventative care. And that this is, we've moved on from those methods. So, I mean, is food different somehow? Like, should we kind of put up with old worldiness in food in a way that we wouldn't in other areas?
I don't necessarily, I mean, my book focuses squarely on food, not medicine. And I'm, you know, I'm certainly a food law and policy expert, but not a medical expert. But with those caveats in mind, I don't think that, you know, just because something is an old world method doesn't make it wrong or fraught with peril. In your example of, you know, someone treating children with lemon juice and claiming that, you know, to have achieved some results that, you know, you prevent the flu with it, say. I think it's a different story to suggest that, you know, what an adult can buy at the store that's been tested and proven to not contain pathogens is sort of a different animal than, you know, someone treating children who are not, you know, by definition are not adults. And so I think there's, you know, it doesn't quite line up as a one-to-one analogy.
Well, there's also preferences and tastes and what your risk level is about eating. Say, if you like rare steak, you can eat rare steak. I think in some countries it's more difficult to have rare steak than it is, or some places. But and on that question about these USDA rules in the mm-hmm. case of the artisanal salumeria, it seemed kind of bizarre. Like, why did the USDA, this happens a bunch in your book where everything seems to be going okay And then some guy at the USDA decides to completely turn on a dime or change a rule that is extremely possibly harmful, puts someone out of business. Does the USDA behave in this sort of random way often?
Or the FDA? Yes, absolutely. and for some reason, based on both, you know, my research and I guess, you know, hearsay from people I've spoken with, the Denver area and USDA inspectors there are particularly notorious for enforcing rules in a way that is different to inspectors around the country, and doing so much more stringently. A lot of rules are, you know, particularly for inspection, are subjective, or at least are treated that way by inspectors. With the USDA, with the FDA, and I recently wrote about a new Canadian food safety law, and one of the main concerns of an attorney, a Canadian food law attorney I spoke with for the article was he worried that, you know, the new laws would be enforced subjectively. This is an enormous problem for, you know, federal, state, and local rules that apply to foods and to, frankly, producers of all kinds and sizes. But obviously, a large food company has much more sway and pull with regulators and lawmakers than does, you know, someone like Mark Donitas, who's making, you know, various cured meats in a, you know, one or two or three man operation.
Is there a process for recourse, or at least attempted recourse? Like, so if he's built his whole business, he's invested a ton of money, you know, there's a heavy financial burden in shutting down or in changing the way that you do things. And then a inspector kind of arbitrarily changes the way that he or she feels about enforcing a law, or maybe, you know, one inspector quits and another one starts. Is there a process by which he can at least say, like, look, you've just destroyed my business through an arbitrary change?
Yes. So he would have had two options. One was that the USDA offered to let him do something called a challenge study, which is essentially you pay scientists a bunch of money to prove that your food is safe. And there's actually, you know, I'm drinking a cup of coffee right now. There's no way to prove that cup of coffee is safe scientifically.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to sort of prove the negative that this contains, you know, nothing that could ever kill one is sort of a fool's errand and a waste of money. And he also would have been, Donitas, not allowed to continue selling his food while he was carrying out this challenge study. So that was a non-starter for him. The other one is just to go through the administrative appeals process. Principles of administrative law. Appeal, your appeal is rejected, you go before an administrative law judge. This goes on for a while, and you win or lose, and ultimately, once you've exhausted your appeals, then you can sue in a court of law. But again, this is a tremendously time-consuming and costly process that, some large food company, Unilever or something, Kraft, might be able to go through, but that some smaller producer just, it's not that they can't be bothered, it's that they can't afford, not to be making money while they're going through this appeals process that can take years.
Yeah, of course. In 2011, President Obama signed the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was a fairly significant overhaul of food safety rules. In general, how has that act been instantiated? I mean, has it been a successful modernization of our food safety standards?
I think it was hailed as this, the biggest development in food safety and food regulation in more than 75 years. I believe that it's modernized food safety in some ways, but it hasn't made food safer, and I don't think it will. The regulations took years to develop, and they're still being rolled out, so it's difficult or impossible to say at this point whether the regulations have actually made food safer. But the general premise, at least the sort of the bells and whistles that the FDA was arguing for in supporting this law, was that it would move the FDA from a reactive to a preventative approach. And that sounds nice. But the math just doesn't really shake out. The FDA, you know, there are two key rules that apply to food that we eat that's grown in this country or produced in this country. One concerns good manufacturing processes, and the other one concerns produce, so fruits and vegetables. And the FDA, in their best case estimate, and I discussed this in my book, I think it was somewhere between 2 and 4% was the their best case for improvements in food safety under this law. And, you know, for $500 million a year, that's not a lot of bang for one's buck. And yeah, there are some reasons for this. One is that the FDA doesn't regulate all of the food supply. Another is that pathogens, foodborne illness, norovirus is actually the most common. You know, it's typically associated with cruise ships, but norovirus is, you know, something that's transferred from someone who's preparing your food typically to you through the food. And the FDA doesn't really have any mechanism for regulating the person who's chopping your lettuce in a restaurant kitchen, for example. So that's 6 out of 10 cases of foodborne illness right there that these regulations can't touch. And so, you know, this is, I think it was, I had always argued, it's a lot of show, and the results, even by the FDA's own numbers, can't possibly have the impact they promised.
So if this has, this new law since 2011 has either improved food safety, or they expect to improve food safety 2 to 4%, which you said doesn't look like that much. What's the FDA's overall track record? Like, do we have evidence that the FDA, like, at all really improves food safety? Like, was food radically less safe before the FDA? Has food safety been improving over time since we've had these kind of broad regulations of whatever form they might take?
Yeah, no, food is definitely safer today than probably at any time in human history in this country and in other developed countries. Which is not to say that foodborne illness doesn't happen, but influenza
just happens at Chipotle a lot.
Chipotle, yeah. And lettuce, yeah, yes,
yeah. I mean, I think that, and I give credit where credit is due. One facet, for example, of the Food Safety Modernization Act that I support, although the FDA didn't want this authority, is that the FDA can order a mandatory recall of food that it knows, or has determined contains some sort of pathogens. Before, it would have to ask the company, and it was a timelier process or more time-consuming process. I support that. I think regulations, some of them have in fact made our food safer. I think the threat of an inspection every once in a while probably improves food safety ever so slightly. But I think generally, you know, we have just as much consumer education, corporate and other practices, social media. You know, Yelp is huge for making sure that we have safer food, because, you know, it's you can trace outbreaks and whatnot to restaurant reviews, and, you know, some food safety researchers are actually doing that now, using it as an accurate determinant of foodborne illness. So, yeah, I think that certainly there are some regulations that we can thank for safer food, but I think that that's only one small part of the much larger picture.
Well, then, in light of that, how common then are situations like Chef Mark Donitis's, and are they kind of just a reason, like, given that there's going to be humans involved in this process, there's going to be, you know, if you have inspectors, there's got to be judgment calls of some kind. People are enforcing it. They might differ slightly. Is stuff like his situation, kind of the a cost worth paying for the overall benefits, knowing that we can't ever have, you know, perfect enforcement where this kind of thing would never happen?
Let's see. So no, no, it's not cost worth bearing. I think that the USDA's actions and certainly other FDA actions that I've looked into, and in, both in the book and elsewhere, if they're not making food safer, then they're simply, as I said earlier, sort of restricting traditional practices, restricting innovation, and some of those traditional practices and innovations could in turn make our food safer in the future. And so, you know, if these sort of arbitrary decisions come down from inspectors, or if regulations are written so poorly that they can be interpreted in a variety of ways, it doesn't make us better off. No one is better off for not being able to eat Mark Donidis's food, and certainly Mark Donidis is not better off for being unable to sell, to produce and sell that food. I think that it's, you know, any regulation that puts someone out of business, even one person, for no reason, is not a regulation worth supporting.
Your book is not just about food safety laws. It's about a lot of laws that govern food. And two of the most fascinating chapters, I think, of the book are the discussion of farm subsidies. So first of all, we hear about farm subsidies when the farm bill comes up, and it seems to have a pretty bipartisan opposition often to farm subsidies. But how do farm subsidies work, and how much or how do they distort our food production system?
I guess the latter question, how much they distort, there's some debate over, you know, exactly how much they influence what we grow and what we eat. And, you know, that's a debate amongst typically agricultural economists. And I'm not sure, I'm not an economist. I haven't settled on sort of which camp I fall into in terms of, you know, the influence of subsidies on you know, what we end up eating. But in terms of what subsidies are and sort of their history, they were Secretary Wallace, who worked under then President FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, came up with the idea that, you know, we were in this national emergency, the Great Depression. And so we would pay farmers, and by we, I mean taxpayers and the government, to not grow as much food, to restrict their food supply, and that would drive up prices and in turn be better for farmers, although not for consumers. And so this was supposed to be, as Secretary Wallace said, quote, a temporary solution to a national emergency. Well, you know, we fast forward something like 80 years and we still have farm subsidies. And you're right that there's a it's a bill that's passed every 5 years, typically. And there's always a broad coalition of people, you know, folks from Cato and other libertarian and conservative DC think tanks, and environmentalist group, you know, the Environmental Working Group, for example, on the left, and other sort of left-leaning food organizations. They all oppose farm subsidies. These, you know, typically are payments to, they were direct payments to farmers who were producing things like corn and soy, along with cotton and some other foods. They changed somewhat in form. We now, as taxpayers, subsidize the insurance, the crop insurance that farmers purchase. And that was supposed to help lower costs, but somehow, as I and many others predicted, rather increased costs for taxpayers. So anyways, this is a, you know, it's been around for 80 years. It's this broad coalition of conservatives, liberals, libertarians who opposed it. But unfortunately, there's a, you know, strong coalition of liberals and conservatives in Congress who are more than happy to dole out these subsidies that as I note in the book and have noted elsewhere, farmers don't need. And yeah, I spoke to the former head of the Iowa soybean growers, visited his farm, and he said, I receive subsidies, but I don't need them. But
how big are these subsidies? Like, if I am, you know, I own a family farm in Iowa, how much money am I getting in subsidies?
It can vary dramatically from nothing to $1 million or more.
But of course, family farms are not really who these subsidies are going to.
Yeah, there are some farms that have received many millions of dollars per year for many years, and those are, you know, giant farms. Small farmers might get either nothing or a smaller amount. I mean, to me, the amount doesn't really matter. I'm opposed to it, whether it's $10 or $10 million. But obviously, the real waste comes in with the $10 million.
And the other chapter I mentioned, I said the two that really struck me are the farm subsidies, but also the other one is the food identity laws. Mm-hmm. You hear about this every now and then or you see it in the grocery store when you see a frozen dairy food product, not called ice cream or something, mm-hmm. or Miracle Whip, as you point out in the book. What are these laws and why shouldn't they exist? You're very explicit to say, well, these shouldn't exist, but how do they affect the food market?
So it's these standards of identity, and basically they were created at the behest of large food producers. Let's say the American Carrot Growers Association. I have no idea if there's an American Carrot Growers Association.
I imagine there is. There's a Raisin Administrative Committee, so I'm sure I imagine there's a carrot one too.
Yeah. When you go to the store and you go to buy them, whether it's at Whole Foods or at Kroger or Safeway, you'll see on the bag of carrots something like U.S. number one. And that means the highest quality in carrot. Basically, what it means is that all the carrots have a particular color and circumference and are free of blemishes. And so the USDA is essentially enforcing cosmetic standards, which even the agency admits and has for decades, have absolutely no bearing on the quality of the food itself. And frankly, people complain about, except people from New Jersey who think that their tomatoes are the best. generally people complain about, the quality of tomatoes.
In the U.S. All the time.
Yeah, they're gorgeous. They're so beautiful, tomatoes are, and they taste like nothing.
That was, I was in Romania in October, and some, like a high school kid from Romania came up to me and he's like, is it true that food in the United States is terrible? And I was like, no, I think it's pretty good. And eventually it turned out that he just was like dissing our tomatoes. Like that was the one thing he knew about food in America was our tomatoes suck.
That's hilarious.
So why
that's a good lesson.
Can we blame the government for that?
Well, we can, because of standards of identity. We can and should. And, it all boils down to the fact that the USDA is enforcing rules for, cosmetic standards that, and so farmers end up producing foods and, raising things that look uniform and that look gorgeous on store shelves, but not so much, on the palate. They're flavorless or sort of lacking. Anyone who shops at a farmer's market probably knows that the carrot they get at the farmer's market might be ugly. It might be misshapen. It might be huge. It might be tiny, but it wouldn't fit the number one carrot standard established by the USDA. And hence, it can't be categorized as that. It's nice that you can sell it at the farmer's market and get a premium for that, and that carrot tastes great. But unfortunately, for the most part, these foods are not on grocery store shelves, these sort of unsightly, misshapen things, because the regulations don't allow you to call your carrot number one if it's has a bend or something like that. So
now, what about things like mayonnaise, or as I you bring up Miracle Whip in the book, which has always been a salad dressing.
Yes.
There are people like mayonnaise, and there are people who are wrong, and that there are Miracle Whip people who like salad dressing. But why is it called a salad dressing?
Because something like 100 years ago, Hellman's, which is, I think, still the industry leader in mayonnaise, argued that there should be essentially a recipe for mayonnaise, and Miracle Whip, which was a lower cost competitor, didn't meet that recipe, that standard of identity established by the federal government. And so it couldn't call itself mayonnaise, and so it went with salad dressing, which is strange. I think I might actually be one of the only people on Earth who's grew up eating a Miracle Whip based salad dressing. my mom would make a Waldorf salad.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Lettuce, apples, walnuts on Thanksgiving. And the Miracle Whip was the key ingredient in the salad dressing.
And that applies
unfortunately,
to
may have been the only one. It's pretty gross. Yeah.
so what's the big deal about that? Because I mean, on the one hand, Miracle Whip is certainly, it's everywhere and people know what Miracle Whip is, and it's stocked next to the mayonnaise. And so if you want it, you can buy it. And then on the other hand, you know, like if you think you're getting mayonnaise and accidentally get Miracle Whip,
it's the worst thing ever.
Yeah, it can ruin your day. So like we could say like, yeah, this is just kind of nonsense and it wouldn't really, you know, they could call it whatever they wanted and it wouldn't bother people. But like, is there a harm, like a real harm from this law still being in place?
There is, and another example that I talk about in the book, I think illustrates this, Florida and the FDA, are amongst, the regulatory bodies that, determine that skim milk, cannot, or could not be called skim milk unless it had certain vitamins added to it. And so there's actually a First Amendment argument that, you know, you can, and a good one at that. You know, that you can have a food that is 100% what it says on the label. Skim milk is skim milk, but if you don't add vitamin A to it, then it's not skim milk. And I think that's you know, the Institute for Justice sued on behalf of a Florida creamery owner to get the state to back down on First Amendment grounds, that, you know, the IJ's client could say, you know, our skim milk is skim milk. And the state had some tortured ideas about, you know, you can't call it skim milk, but how about, quote, non-grade A milk product, natural milk vitamins removed. And the farmer said, what the hell is that?
What's that word? Mellareme? Or was that?
Oh, yeah. Mellareme. Yeah, that's another thing. That was, and you find, and that's a great example, just of the sort of influence of large food producers. You know, you can call something a particular food name, but, you know, if there's some sort of intervention by a large food company, then, you know, you're going to be forced to call your food something that has absolutely no meaning whatsoever. And you, you know, it's basically using the English language to sort of force you into submission.
Mellareme, you know, was invented by, it seemed like almost by Big Dairy, who wanted a different name for cream related products or something like that.
It was mainly, it referred to, it was an invented word, that was used to, I think, refer to like non-dairy creamers.
Yeah.
You know, the kind that you get in a hotel room in a little, weird pouch. Mm-hmm. And, so yeah, it was, you know, you can't call this creamer. You've got to call it Mellareme, which again, you know, relegates you to the Mellareme aisle at the grocery store, and of course there isn't one.
But as you point out in the book, the people who this does seem to hurt, especially because we now are living in this. I mean, food has changed a lot in the last 20 years in America. The growth of organic, the growth of people caring about, you know, farm to table, sustainable agriculture. I want this done old world style, as we discussed previous. And the skim milk you discussed with the IJ case, I mean, that was as pure of milk as they could make. And they were advertising it as a very sustainable, pure form of milk that they couldn't call milk. And it seems to these laws and also subsidies and the amalgamation of slaughterhouses and stuff seem to hurt the people who are trying to innovate in food.
Definitely. I mean, in the case of Donitas, it's someone who's innovating by using old world methods. So, you know, innovation by returning to the traditional. But in other cases, there's, you know, the Mayo competitor I discuss, Just Mayo, in the book. They were sued first by Unilever, which produces Hellmann's, and then the FDA cracked down on them being able to use the word mayo, in large part because they, you know, their food was a plant-based alternative that contained no eggs. It was suitable for vegans and vegetarians, and this was not something that Hellmann's could stand for. You know, we've already squelched out competition from that salad dressing Miracle Whip. You know, we need to make sure that that the grocery aisles are not tainted by the presence of a competitor that's innovating. And
it's also people who want to slaughter cows differently. You talk about the consolidation of slaughterhouses, or if you want to discuss the buying the cow when you see it on the side of the road, but you have to ship it 200 miles.
Yeah, it's a very, very frustrating approach. So up until and this, you know, as an attorney and just as someone who appreciates the law and the Constitution for what it says, what it means. In 1967, Congress gave the USDA, and I mentioned this in the book, a power that it didn't actually possess itself. You know, it's interesting when Congress delegates, and we can, you know, certainly argue about the wisdom and or efficacy of that action. But it's even better when Congress delegates power even it doesn't have to an agency. And so in 1967, Congress told the USDA, hey, you know what, you can regulate the intrastate inspection and slaughter and processing of animals, you know, pigs and cows and whatnot, and establish this system known as Equal To, in which states either can operate their own slaughter and processing inspections that are at least equal to, in terms of stringency, USDA rules, or the USDA itself will send inspectors in to the state. And these days, about half the states operate their own systems, and half the states rely on the USDA to do that inspection. But how can the USDA have the authority to regulate something that happens only in one state? You know, the slaughter of a cow in Fresno, when the steaks are from that cow are not going to leave the state, that's wholly within the jurisdiction of California, if it wants to regulate that. And yet, we have this system that essentially you know, cramps and hampers small producers. Years before 1967, the USDA had passed regulations, you know, some of which were needed. The Meat Inspection Act of the early 1900s sought to address some pretty disgusting conditions, particularly in the stockyards and slaughterhouses in Chicago. And yeah, but it basically it was supposed to fight consolidation, but all it's done is drive consolidation. And so, as you pointed out, you know, if you're a farmer and you're raising a cow, oftentimes you have to send the cow hundreds of miles away, oftentimes out of state, to have an you know, it slaughtered. And oftentimes, and I've heard from so many farmers, I can't even begin to tell you, in conversations with them, you know, they'll send their cow away, and it's a stressful thing for the animal. It's, you know, not great. Obviously, it'd be better if there was some slaughterhouse abattoir in town. But the regulations don't promote that. And so you know, have someone sending a cow away, and what you get back, you can't always be sure it's your cow, your steaks. And there's there are a whole host of other problems. You get back, you know, an odd number of hoops, and you remember your cow had, you know, four of them when you sent it away.
And if you're trying to guarantee your free range grass fed beef for your specific business model, that doesn't seem to help very much. If you don't,
it crushes you. And when there's a food safety recall, as happens, not only do you know the large producers who, not always but often, are the the cause of the problem in the first place. But every cow that went through that same slaughterhouse and was inspected and presumably then passed inspection, all that meat gets recalled. So, you know, you're this local artisanal grass-fed beef farmer and you send your cow away, which you don't want to do. But then, you know, the plant has some salmonella or E. coli outbreak. Well, you're going to lose your cow. You're going to lose all that meat, even if you're, you know, you sent the cow away and it was had no bacteria. And even if it doesn't presently have any bacteria, you're out of luck, which is, I just can't imagine how frustrating and mind-numbingly upsetting that is.
What do you think the chances are of things getting better in this area? I mean, in particular, like it seems that America is increasingly kind of a foodie culture. And the artisanal and the old world and all these sorts of things and the farm to table and local and all that, which are the things that seem to run into a lot of problems with the regulations, the laws that you've talked about. Those are becoming more and more popular, have more cultural cachet. And so do you think that we'll see kind of a counter movement as this foodie culture starts running more and more into the FDA's regulatory culture?
Thank you for allowing me some optimism. but yes, I absolutely think not only that that you know can happen and that it will happen, but I think it is happening actually already. And I think it's happening largely at the state level. So you have states like it's an interesting list of states too. Wyoming, North Dakota, Maine, California have all passed laws within the last few years that either have a designation of as a food freedom law or that sort of check the boxes of that sort of law, one that allows more home-based cooks to get involved in the food supply and, you know, that it sort of embraces a much lighter regulatory burden on small food producers. And I think that that's a fantastic you know, step towards improving food in the way that you suggested, you know, that we have more choices from local producers and in a way that doesn't impact the, you know, capabilities or the rights of larger food producers either.
And but as you kind of alluded to there at the end, we talked a lot about the federal government, but the states and municipalities have a lot of onerous food regulations too. But also, it may be easier to take action there if you can get together with people from your farmer's market and try and get rid of some onerous regulations than it is to fight big dairy.
That's absolutely true. I mean, the flip side is that it's also, you know, it's easier to pass good laws at the local level than it is at the federal level. But obviously, it's equally easier to pass terrible laws at the local level. And that's what the, you know, the sort of the fourth substantive chapter of my book focuses on, sort of awful local food regulations that, you know, prevent people from doing things like having a garden in their yard. And so, you know, it's a two-edged sword, but I think it's still worth pushing for better and lighter regulations at the local level.
Thanks for listening. Free Thoughts is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.